Hello everyone, my name is Ryan and you are listening to the Vegan Report. There is one thing that Big Ag absolutely does not want us to talk about, and that is slaughterhouses. So let's talk about it in depth for this entire episode. Let's talk about why they are hidden, the harm they cause, not just to animals, but also human societies and the environment. And most importantly, let's talk about how to close them down for good. To discuss this topic, I have with me Dr. Amy Fitzgerald, a professor and researcher at the University of Windsor. She has written multiple books, such as Animal Advocacy and Environmentalism, Understanding and Bridging the Divide, Animals as Food, Reconnecting Production, Processing, Consumption, and Impacts, Animal Abuse and Family Violence, Researching the Interrelationships of Abusive Power, and A Social History of the Slaughterhouse from Inception to Contemporary Implications, which is not a book, but the article that inspired me to reach out to Dr. Fitzgerald, a must-read you can access by following the link in the description below. Thank you, Amy, for having accepted my invitation and for being here.
It's my pleasure.
I want to first get to why slaughterhouses are such unique institutions. And let me start by this. You quote in your paper Vieyes, I think his name is, who writes, "Whereas the slaughter of a few animals may be a festive occasion, slaughter on a larger scale is different. It is disturbing. Therefore, means must be found of putting it out of mind." Why do we differentiate the slaughter of a few animals versus the slaughter on a large scale? I mean, psychologically, because we hear lots of vegans talk about speciesism and the absurdity of treating a dog according to a certain set of standards and a cow according to others. But I don't think I have heard much talks about the number of animal slaughters and if that made a difference.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in order to properly answer it, I need to kind of contextualize slaughterhouses historically. So the slaughterhouse as we currently know it is relatively new. So historically, people killed, you know, a few animals in their backyards for their own personal consumption. But then in the 19th century, there was a shift from, you know, small-scale backyard slaughtering of animals to moving it to a more central place. And interestingly, one of the reasons for that move was that reformers at the time were concerned about the public being exposed to the visuals of animals being slaughtered, and also the sounds, the smells, etc. And so they were moved from public places and became unique institutions. So instead of, you know, in the past when the animals were killed small scale in people's backyards or personal consumption, now you had a unique space being created for that purpose. Actually, in France in the 19th century, it became necessary to coin a term, abattoir, to refer to this new space that was created. And it was when they shifted out of public spaces, they were made quite nondescript. So you wouldn't necessarily see one and know one, just like today, right? They're hard to identify. And Vieyes actually refers to it as a place that is no place, right? It's hard to pinpoint what you're looking at unless you know what to look for. And so then there was a shift where they started industrializing. So they went from, you know, concentrated killing of animals to all of a sudden this larger scale killing of animals that was made possible by mechanization, you know, increased in number of workers into the facilities, et cetera. And so then through this industrialization, then we see large slaughterhouses emerge, which are quite different and actually not just conceptually different, but also empirically have different relationships with things like community impacts than small scale slaughterhouses do.
And what is it about, coming back to my question, why, do we react, we're joyful when it's like a village festival or something, a farming festival, and we're killing a few pigs. But with slaughterhouses, there's something graphic. The footage of it makes people deeply uncomfortable, and even some of them become vegan as a consequence. So, what is it psychologically in humans that make us, make that differentiation?
Well, there are a number of perspectives on that. One individual, Norbert Elias, has referred to it as part of a broader so-called civilizing process, where instead of serving animals with the full body on the table, for instance, right, which had been standard practice. People became increasingly uncomfortable, and it was a shift away from, our own animality, right? That we needed to separate the actual visual of the animal that we were consuming. And so then you see the shift towards, the more out of sight, out of mind, the better. And with currently the industry, it has helped to serve their ends, right? Because people don't go poking around looking for slaughterhouses generally, unless they're activists who have an interest in that specific space. But consumers don't search them out, right? So the less they know, the better. That's the way the industry feels, and it's certainly the way a lot of consumers feel. So just to illustrate that point, historically, like in the stockyards in Chicago, which in the US was kind of the mecca of animal slaughtering at one point in history, you used to be able to do tours, and they were quite celebrated, right? That was like the tourist thing to do when you were in Chicago. Now you can't get near a slaughterhouse. I certainly can't, right? It's quite uncommon that they would allow the public to come in to see what's going on there. And also, the flip side of that is it would be relatively uncommon for consumers to want to see, how their meat is produced, because it's not a particularly savory process.
That's fascinating. And so what I understand from what you're saying is that our ancestors would not be as shocked by slaughterhouses as we would.
Yeah, and I think, the scale also has something to do with it. So not only is it part of a broader cultural process of trying to separate ourselves from our own animality, but also the scale of it now is so immense. And a lot of consumers, I think, don't realize how many animals are killed in slaughterhouses, how quickly they're killed, which is one of the reasons that work in the industry has, among the highest injury and illness rates because of the speed. So remember, I was talking about the mechanization of animal slaughtering, and part of that was this, conveyor system. So it's, like in the automotive manufacturing industry, there's the assembly line where you assemble cars. Well, this is kind of the disassembly line where you kill and process animal body parts. And it's quite fast, right? A number of authors have talked about the speed, but one of the consequences of that is not only does it raise a number of animal welfare concerns, but also, employee welfare concerns because of the speed at which they have to work. So the workers lost control over the speed of their own work, and now it's, the companies that set those speeds.
If I'm not mistaken, Henry Ford got inspired for his factory model by a visit to a Chicago-based slaughterhouse.
Yes, yep, that story has been cited in a number of papers and books that, yeah, it became, there's this connection between the two industries. And interestingly, animal slaughtering tends to be classified as a form of manufacturing. Although, as I talk about in my paper and, in books that I've written, the industry is it's unique, right? It's categorized as manufacturing, but it's inherently different when you're working on sentient beings. You're not just working on, creating widgets or what have you, right? It's you're engaged with sentient beings and then processing their bodies after they're killed.
I guess there are two characteristics that we have talked about that truly differentiate slaughterhouses as an institution from others. First of all, they are hidden and they are trying very hard to get out of our sight. Also, the business model has to do with killing sentient beings. Can you talk more about that business model and how it's fundamentally different from business as we know it and, ways of making money?
Sure. And one of the ways that, well, there are a number of things that point to the differences. One thing that is stands out, and this is a relatively recent development in some countries, is the passage of so-called ag gag laws, where it criminalizes certain activities by whistleblowers, et cetera, who then can't, for fear of their own well-being, report on what they see in their workplace. Whether or not they were, it becomes tricky to identify individuals who were employed in that work and then had concerns or took that work on specifically because they were looking for concerns. But regardless, the development of ag gag laws is, quite unique to the industry. There aren't many other industries that legislatures determine we need special laws, and some have argued that criminalize already criminal behavior, right? It's a way of kind of dampening the resolve to expose what goes on in those industries. So, and where I live in Ontario, ours was just partially, mostly, our ag gag law was shut down. And kudos to Animal Justice here in Canada, who was able to convincingly argue in court that the law was problematic and violated a number of freedoms among workers and activists. So there's that protectionism of the industry that we see. There are also different empirical consequences. So one of the things that I've done in my research, and I did this study with doctors Linda Kaloff and Thomas Dietz, a number of years ago now, and we analyzed the relationship between slaughterhouse employment levels in counties in the US and crime rates. And you might be wondering, well, why, why do that? And the reason is I was actually doing reading because I'm interested in the environmental impacts of animal agriculture. And I was reading on that subject and came across a number of studies by anthropologists, geographers who were studying slaughterhouse communities. And so, to step back a little bit again, back into the historical development of the slaughterhouse, in the later mid to late 20th century, slaughterhouses in a number of countries started to move from urban centers to rural communities because they realized it would be more cost effective to move the slaughtering closer to where the animals are raised. And so as a consequence of that shift, a number of rural small communities ended up with these large industries coming in, and it changed the communities in a number of ways. So these researchers were documenting these changes, and they pointed to a number of changes that they saw, like increased demand for housing, social services, etc. But one of the interesting things that they mentioned was that crime increased, and they weren't sure why crime would increase when slaughterhouses came in, because it was outpacing the increase in population, right? So we couldn't explain it just based on population increase alone. And so we did a study to assess, are these is there a relationship between slaughterhouse employment and crime? And we statistically controlled for a number of variables that would be associated with crime, like proportion of young men in the population, et cetera. And we also included comparison industries. So we identified industries where they were similar to slaughterhouse employment as far as, relatively high injury and illness rates. But the difference was, you weren't, killing and processing animal bodies in those industries. And so when we ran the analyses, it was clear that slaughterhouse employment level was associated with crime rates, specifically violent crime rates, but the comparison industries were not. So empirically, that indicates that there's something unique about slaughterhouse employment levels. And we need further research to kind of unpack that to figure out, okay, what's going on that accounts for these differences. But it is interesting that empirically they're different. And what we found in the analysis was when we looked at small scale slaughterhouses, they really didn't have that strong association with crime rates. It was these large slaughterhouses that had, the strongest relationship, statistically significant relationship with crime rates. And like I said, we controlled for a number of other correlates of crime, like population density, proportion of young men, and proportion of immigrant population in the county, because that's one thing that when communities had voiced concerns because of increasing crime rates, a number of the companies were scapegoating the employees and saying, oh, it's because, we can't find local workers, so we've had to bring in immigrant workers. So basically blaming immigrant labor. But the criminologist in me, read that and thought, well, that's interesting because there are a number of studies that show that the proportion of immigrants in a community is not associated with increased crime rates. In a number of studies, it's actually associated with a decrease in crime rates. So that's not the explanation either. So that's just a very long way of saying there's something unique about slaughterhouse employment, and the industry because of the nature of the work. Killing and processing animals.
I want to get back to the workers, but first, yes, you're right. This industry is in bed with the government. And they receive subsidies. They have captured some of our MPs who then push their unconstitutional laws. How did that relationship, that union between slaughterhouses and big ag industry and the government was created?
Well, I think part of it has to do with the consolidation in the industry. So increasingly throughout the, you know, late 20th century, there was a consolidation of, you know, slaughterhouse facilities were being bought up by large companies. So increasingly it was, you know, has become an industry run by a handful of companies for the most part. So it gave those companies enhanced power, and it made lobbying that much easier, right? Because you had fewer people at the table. And so it has certainly made, you know, food, the animal agriculture, animal slaughtering and processing, you know, one of the largest lobbying groups in a number of countries. And that lobbying, I think, as we're seeing more more concerns being raised, you know, it seems like the lobbying has amplified as well, right? Historically, you know, there wasn't that much to be concerned about, I suppose, from animal groups. But now, especially, you know, one of your guests on an earlier episode was talking about social media, and social media has had a significant role, I think, because now, you know, you don't need to rely on news media to show videos, undercover videos in slaughterhouses or animal agriculture more generally, right? Someone can just post it on social media and all of a sudden you have, you know, thousands, if not millions of people seeing that video. And that certainly has an impact. So I have, you know, I've noticed a number of other academics have spoken about the increased defensiveness among the industry, because it seems like these efforts are having an impact. If they weren't, there would be no need to have ad gag laws. And yet they, you know, different jurisdictions, you know, have been implementing them in recent years.
That's, I guess, a kind of silver lining. You know, it's a positive spin to their efforts of, you know, closing down the discourse around what they're doing. They feel threatened.
Yes, they certainly do, and it's also industries around them as well. Like now with you know, transport companies that transport animals to slaughter, increasingly they're concerned about, you know, activists showing up at slaughterhouses as, you know, vigils. And we had an interesting legal case here in Ontario, where an activist was charged criminally for giving water to a pig on the way to slaughter. You know, I think it could be argued that in the past that wouldn't have happened because that activist wouldn't have been seen as a threat. Right. An inconvenience maybe, but not a threat that warranted calling the police, and having charges laid.
And you talked about the mechanization aspect, and I guess, you know, we think about science and innovation as a way to maybe free ourselves from, this industry and have lab grown meat and things like that in the future. But maybe they're also thinking, you know, big ag slaughterhouses. We can maybe go further with that mechanization process. Maybe we can get rid ourselves from the workers entirely and have, you know, entirely automated slaughterhouses. Is that science fiction, or have you read or heard about plans of doing that?
Well, I can't speak to whether or not there are specific plans of doing that, but you can see the trend over time of fewer workers. And that's one of the reasons that the labor power of workers in the industry has weakened. Historically, in a number of countries, slaughterhouse work was relatively well paid. But then, you know, as we see this consolidation of ownership over animal slaughtering, we see a declining number of workers and a declining power of their labor and unionization. So I can say that there has been that, certainly that trend over time. And of course, you know, as we see further developments technologically, perhaps that will, you know, that will continue.
Another question I have, and, you know, maybe you have the answer, maybe not, but something I often think about is the executives of those slaughterhouses. I feel like those people are in an office and they don't really leave the office. For them, you know, all of those animals and workers and all of what we were talking about, those are just numbers on a spreadsheet. What do you think of them? You know, because we often put, you know, focus on the manual workers who are in the slaughterhouse itself. But what about those who witness the impact of the slaughterhouse from a, you know, close standpoint, you know, closer than activists, and, you know, they're aware of what's happening, but they don't do anything about it. Do you have some thoughts about those people?
Well, I suppose like any business, you know, where there are profits to be made, you know, it can facilitate kind of looking in the other direction, and not critically examining what, you know, what you're, the type of work that you're doing. And I think this is one area where you really see the intersections of, you know, animal welfare, human welfare, environmental welfare. They clearly intersect, right? No one wins from this industry except for, you know, stockholders and, you know, the executives perhaps. But it's an area where that's one reason why I don't like when people kind of, you know, try to scapegoat the individual workers, right? Like, or denigrate them. This has happened historically, right? Where, you know, in the 18th century, people were, you know, denigrating slaughterers because they didn't want to be associated with them, etc., because they felt that there was something problematic about that type of work. The reality is, you know, individuals need work. And this is an area where there are jobs because the turnover is so high. In some companies, it's as high as 100% per year, entirely new workforce, right? So it's not the individual workers in the facilities that, you know, are the so-called enemy. And so that's, you know, that's one thing that I think would help if people paid attention to these interconnections, right? That it's not just about animal welfare. It's about, you know, the welfare of the workers, the welfare of people who live in the community around, the facilities. So that I think the more that we help spread that knowledge, I think that can be quite helpful, so that people realize, because let's face it, some people aren't motivated by the animal welfare arguments, right? I've been, trying to, I've been voicing those arguments for decades now. Those arguments don't seem to be the convincing arguments, unfortunately. It tends to be the arguments where you can say, look, here's something that's connected with, animal concerns, but also human concerns, also environmental concerns that, are going to negatively impact humans. We're a very self-centered species. So the more that we can point to human impacts, I think that's strategically helpful, but also for the workers caught up in the system, I think it's helpful as well to kind of try to give voice to their experiences, and see the connections between workers' rights and animal rights.
One last question about the business model. You're a criminologist. Do you think that the kind of, people who work as executives, managers of those slaughterhouses, and even maybe the manual workers, do you think many of them are have antisocial personality, that this kind of business attracts people who have a antisocial personality?
I don't know, and it's an area, it's a question I get asked a lot, and I think it's an area where we need further research. Because we can, based on the research that we have right now, we can only kind of speculate, but we really do need further research to kind of see, okay, if empirically there is a relationship between slaughterhouse employment levels and crime in communities, why is that the case, and kind of focus in on those potential relationships. Now the problem is it's hard to get funding to conduct research like that, right? It's not like the industry is going to fund that for obvious reasons, right? So it's definitely a challenge. But it's an area where we definitely need more research to see, okay, what's going on here with, employment. And based on anecdotal evidence, from workers that I've spoken with and that other academics, have quoted in their own work, it's very diff the hands-on, disassembly line work is very challenging physically, emotionally, and it's probably one of the reasons that the turnover rate in the industry tends to be so high. But of course, then the turnover rate exacerbates the underlying problems, right? Because then you have workers who are, they haven't been there long, so they're not as well trained as in other industries, which can contribute to, injuries, can contribute to animal welfare issues, because you don't have people who have been in these jobs for a long period of time. So it's, it's just a very long-winded way of saying that we need, I can't draw any conclusions about your question because we really do need more research.
But it's not a definitive no.
Right. Yeah. I can't say that it's definitely off the table. But I can't, empirically confirm it either.
Okay, let's now talk about the impact of slaughterhouses on their workers, but also the community at large. And we touched on that, of course. And I want to start with something a past guest had told me. You know, she told me about Syrian refugees who came to Canada and how the government pushed them into slaughterhouse jobs. And she expressed how horrifying that was, you know, taking refugees from war zones and then pushing them into slaughterhouses. But then I, you know, posted that, you know, clip of her saying that. And to my surprise, many people commented, you know, how dare they complain, you know, about this. You know, we're welcoming them into the country and we're offering them a good job. Why is this cruel? So I'm asking you the question, why is it cruel to send, you know, Syrian refugees to slaughterhouses for work?
Well, as I mentioned, it's objectively based on, you know, reports, it's among the highest injury and illness rates. The turnover, as I said, is really high. So it's not like you're setting them up in a career that's going to be, you know, a great, stable, safe career, right? The reality is the industry, not just in Canada, in other countries, needs workers. And this is how it, you know, populates the workforce in some places. In addition to refugees, there are also programs in some countries where incarcerated individuals are used in slaughterhouses, which also raises a number of, you know, issues. Even if you take out the animal component entirely, objectively speaking, when you're talking about high injury and illness rates, you know, it's probably not a good thing to put, you know, vulnerable people in, because it's going to be hard for them to speak against power, right? So if they see something, it's going to be hard for them to say something because they have relatively little power, and are concerned about keeping their employment. So it's definitely an area where I think we need more education to explain, you know, to the Canadian government, other governments, that there are some problems here. And as I've been, you know, mentioning, the industry is unique. You can't just assume it's going to be like putting someone in an automotive manufacturing plant, right? A different manufacturing. They're different, and they need to be treated differently. And I'll give you an example. So the Canadian government, Correction Services Canada, closed down. We used to have six penitentiary farms. They closed them down, and then decided, a different government decided, you know, approximately 10 years later, that they were going to reopen the farms. And the proposal that they put forth was an industrial scale goat dairy, where incarcerated individuals would be working. And in the messaging about it, there's this conflation of, well, you know, animal assisted therapy is good. It's, you know, been proven to have positive impacts, but they don't critically reflect upon the fact that this is not animal assisted therapy. It's a very different context. Working in an industrial animal agriculture facility, whether it's on the, you know, raising animals or killing and processing animals, it's not animal therapy. It's intentionally set up in a way so that people don't form relationships with those animals, because that would be problematic to the system, right? So there's no therapeutic relationship going on there. But in the messaging about these programs, it's like, you know, they don't pay attention to that. They don't address it. It's like, we'll just throw animals in and stir, and then we're going to have these therapeutic benefits. And so I've been arguing, against that proposal. It's, as of right now, it's been tabled, but we'll see what happens with it. Because there aren't therapeutic benefits. And, as I've been saying, it's not an industry where you're going to have, where it's going to be an easy job. And I mean easy in the sense of, free of injury, illness. And it's also increasingly not an area where there's, a lot of careers being, set up where you can go into it and then, you're set in a career for life. So instead, programs that help provide meaningful certifications where people can use those certifications, whether they're coming out of an incarceration situation or they're coming into the country as a refugee, set them up with meaningful work that's going to lead to a meaningful career, not, a job in an industry where the turnover rate is so high, they're not going to be there long. It's not a stable working environment.
I'm thinking of what kind of response they would give to your answer. And I guess they could say, let's just create trainings, training sessions, more training sessions, or revisit our training sessions. And let's give our workers more, protective tools. And so I guess my question is this industry, will this industry always harm its workers? Is it, fundamentally flawed this way? Or is there a way to improve the life of those workers?
There is a way to improve the life of the workers, but it would take money, which would cut into profits. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is that the industry works on a very thin profit line per animal. So it relies on scale. So they need to have more animals in order to make more profit, right? Otherwise, they would have to increase the price that they're charging for their products. And that's something, as we see in the current inflationary period that we're in a number of countries, that people are very resistant to. A lot of people don't want to pay more for animal products. A lot of people can't pay more for animal products, yet they believe that that's the only way that they can exist. Their diet needs to have animals as part of it. And so there's a real resistance to the industry increasing pricing, which would be required, I think, to provide the workers with what they would need for an ideal situation, and even to enhance animal welfare. I mean, I know there, we don't have time to get into this huge debate between, animal welfare approaches versus, animal liberation approaches. But there are definitely things that could be done in the industry that would enhance animal welfare, but they would take time. Slowing down the disassembly line would improve animal welfare. It would improve worker welfare. Some would argue it would improve the safety of the food that's produced in these facilities. But it would eat into profits. There probably aren't a lot of people listening to a podcast focused on veganism who aren't vegan, but there might be some. And what I would urge those listeners to do is to think about whether or not you want to provide the industry with money, knowing what you now know, right? That it's not, there aren't just, there aren't just animal impacts, there are human impacts as well. And I think we need to we need to think about those and keep them front of mind. And also, as I tell my students, and I realize it's rare when I teach a class where there's more than like one or two, students who identify as vegan. But I tell them, even if you're not vegan, you should be concerned about an industry that you're buying products from that is doing everything it can to keep consumers, keep the public out of that industry, out of seeing what's going on, that has, such a vested interest in making sure that there is no transparency, that supports ad gag laws because they're afraid of what's going to be reported. I think anyone, vegan, non-vegan alike, should be concerned about that.
Another point I want to bring up is the public health aspect of it. There are a lot of vegans out there who make the health argument for veganism, but it's always, an individualistic, argument, from a me perspective. Your diet will improve and your health will improve. But I don't hear much, talks about the public health argument. Around veganism. So, why are slaughterhouses dangerous for public health?
Well, the industry as a whole has a number of associated problems or externalities with it that have been documented in the literature. And one of the main reasons is because of, and it's again something a lot of people don't want to talk about, but it's the amount of manure that's produced. Manure is really problematic because it has, high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus in it, which can then cause problems when it gets into the water. There are manure lagoons that can be created, but of course they're not perfect if there's a natural disaster. So for instance, hurricanes, if you just Google hurricane and manure lagoon, you'll see all sorts of pictures of, manure lagoons being breached from floodwaters and things like that. So there are a number of, a number of public health related concerns around where they're located, which is why there's, as there's increasing awareness about this, there's increasing resistance among communities who don't want them to set up shop in their communities. So, for instance, there was a community in Montana that invited me, Great Falls, Montana, that invited me to give a talk prior to a screening of a documentary. And there were a number of people who were there to share their thoughts. And one thing that I thought was really cool about that event was that they were bringing in a variety of people to talk about the problems of this from a number of angles, right? So there were people there who were speaking to the environmental impacts, people who were speaking to the social community impacts, people speaking about the animal welfare impacts. So you could really see the connections, and I think that helped to kind of give a full picture. So, and public health is part of that. There's research that shows that property values around these facilities drop dramatically. So for those who, don't necessarily care about the environment, animals, other people, sometimes they're swayed by their own property values taking a dive as a result. And there are also studies that have documented, the public health impacts for the workers, right? Increased risk of all sorts of respiratory illnesses, zoonotic illnesses, right? COVID-19 kind of shined a light on the industry, as far as, the transmission of COVID-19 between the workers, was so high. And there are studies that, have shown that individuals who work in animal facilities are at greater risk of contracting zoonotic illnesses and, and also then transmitting them to their families. So you can see, the public health impacts. There are many potential impacts, and like I said, they're well documented in the literature. Scientists have been documenting them for a few decades now. And so it's, you can just look to the literature and find all of these documented studies that show that the risks increase with these types of organizations.
I want to now get to the activism part and how to fight this, because you're making, such great points. I mean, every argument points to every piece of information and study we have points to, this is a bad idea. This is not a smart idea. We should abolish those institutions. And then you have activism work around it. First of all, would you, rate the efficiency? We talked about, how social media has helped, putting the pressure on them and making them feel threatened. But then you have, people breaking in, doing, sit-ins inside. You have, the Animal Liberation Front who enters those places and liberate animals. So you have all kinds of activism around slaughterhouses. Do you have an idea of which ones are the most efficient in terms of making an impact and getting us near the goal of abolishing those institutions?
I guess my thoughts are, I think the most effective are those where we can kind of form coalitions around the issues. So, joining forces with environmentally focused organizations and individuals and knowing, okay, there are going to be some differences, right? You're not going to be dealing with a group that's, entirely vegan or, same thing with workers' rights groups. But I think forming those coalitions is helpful because sometimes I think it's easy to for the general public to kind of look away from animal-focused messaging, right? Because for all the reasons we've been talking about, people don't want to think about where their meat comes from, where their dairy comes from, their eggs, etc. And so it's easy for them to shut down. But if you're making a broader argument around not just the animals, but also, human rights, environmental justice, I think then you can, the effect of the message might spread a little more widely. And I like what one of your previous guests, Robert Cheek, had to say about, it's really hard to bring people over to your side if you're, calling them names and telling them how horrible they are. But it helps if you can, show people these connections and, convince people that even if you don't care about the animal issues, they're interconnected with so many other issues and concerns, and hit them where they live, and that's their own personal well-being for, for many people. And, point to all of these, all of the implications of this industry. And also, I think it helps to put it into historical context and show people like this is historically speaking, relatively new development. It's not like we're stuck with it, right? It's not like it's, part of our You know, it's not etched into our DNA or something, right? It's a relatively new social institution, and it can be changed. It just takes people, you know, being willing to mobilize and you know, and work with other people. And I think that helps to, you know, get the message out, and also fighting as hard as possible against these, you know, legislative aims and strategies to, you know, prevent the public from gaining information about what's going on. You know, I think people should have the right to know how their food is being produced. And I don't think there's anything all that controversial in that statement, right? And so I think conveying that to people might help to kind of make them think, okay, yeah, that's a fair point. And I think it can help sometimes to put yourself in a position where you can be a model for other people and say, okay, you know, I was once in the position that you were. I didn't know what was going on, but now I do, and here's how I live my life as a result. And I think that's important. And to be honest with you, it's something I didn't used to do as much as I do now. And it occurred to me one day, I was teaching a class, and it was corporate and governmental crime class. And we were talking about, you know, a number of different industries, and we were talking about the animal agriculture industry. And at one point, one of my students raised his hands and said, "But what's the solution? It's not like we can all be vegan, we would die." And he really thought that, right? And so at that moment, I realized, okay, I need to start telling my students that I'm vegan because otherwise they really do believe these things, right? And some of that is, you know, sponsored by the industry itself, right? Tell people that they're going to die from protein deficiencies, or, you know, that they need meat to survive. And so I think sometimes it can help to put yourself out there and say, okay, look, this is, you know, this is totally feasible for you to do. But, you know, my caveat to that is be ready for people to try to discredit what you're saying because you're taking that position, because you're vegan. Even if you're speaking about something that's totally unrelated. And I've had that happen. I actually just had an instance of it a couple months ago where I had to appear as an expert witness in a court case, and it was totally unrelated to food. And one of the first things during cross-examination that was raised was, you know, Dr. Fitzgerald, would you agree that eating meat is wrong? And I thought, and I answered it honestly, but I thought the question has nothing to do with the case. But the reason it was raised was to try to discredit everything else that I was saying. So I think the more that people, you know, put themselves out there and identify, you know, as healthy vegans, I think that, you know, can help. But like I said, just be ready because you will have people who will challenge everything you have to say, because you've made that position clear.
But what about the mental health aspect of it? Because, you know, you're studying this and it's a dark topic, you know. And I guess it has its effects on your mental health. I mean, just thinking about slaughterhouses, I often wonder, is it my moral obligation to, you know, do something like animal liberation front activists do and just go there? You know, it's a hour drive from where I live, and try to, you know, save an animal, you know. is it not, you know, my moral obligation? And then you have, you know, the mental charge of having, you know, just yesterday there was a birthday thing with work, and they had some cake, and the cake was not vegan. So I just, you know, took a cup of coffee, and I was holding the cup of coffee, and everyone was eating the cake. And I was thinking, yeah, there is a mental charge. There's a cost to identifying as vegan and moving in society. And then, of course, I had, you know, a barrage of questions from coworkers about my veganism. So what do you make of the mental health aspect of it? You know, because we want to be strategic, we want to be rational in our activism, but at the same time we have all of those feelings. So yeah,
that's a really good question. And I will say, as someone who's a long time vegan, it has gotten easier. And I think because we're seeing real social change, you know, so part of the reason it's gotten easier is probably just, you know, I take it for granted now, and that's just how I live my life. But I think we're seeing real social change around us. So now, you know, people will ask questions, and I think they're, you know, they're genuine, well-meaning questions, like, you know, why are you vegan? How'd you become vegan? And so, you know, I like to use that opportunity to help explain to people, you know, as delicately as possible, sometimes depending on the circumstance. But yeah, I mean, there are, you know, mental health aspects of it too, I suppose, right? Living your life in a way that is so counter to the norm. And I'd be lying if I said it, you know, it isn't frustrating at times, you know, when people are, you know, offering you money to, if you'll eat a burger, you know, I'll give you $2,000, or, you know, things like that. So it can be challenging, but I am seeing that it's improving, right? That there's less view of it as being, you know, problematic or unhealthy, right? When I first started my vegan journey, you know, countless people would tell me how unhealthy I was going to be, etc. And now I don't have people saying that. I have people asking me questions because now they're concerned about their own health, right? So how do you do it? Do you have any suggestions? Because, you know, my doctors told me I need to make some real changes. So it has improved. But like I said, there's definitely a toll to be paid, knowing that you will have, you know, what you say questioned because you are a vegan. And that, you know, that frustrates me. It's always frustrated me, and it will no doubt always frustrate me.
A last question. Many people use the Holocaust comparison, you know, to talk about slaughterhouses. For some, you know, it is offensive, but let me ask you, is it accurate? And should we use it for activism work?
There are a number of, you know, activist organizations and even, you know, some of my fellow academics that point to, you know, other horrible events in human history where people have been enslaved and, you know, killed and, you know, in large numbers. And I think I don't see that there's a whole lot to be gained from those comparisons. I think that each is unique in its own ways. And I, especially given what it, I think are such the importance of paying attention to the ways that animal well-being, human well-being, environmental well-being are all interconnected. I don't think that we need to point to other examples and say, okay, you know, this is bad because that was bad. We know this is bad. And I think we can make that case without pointing to other examples, to try and make the case for us.
Another question I had was about the perspective on this issue and how future generations will think of slaughterhouses. Hopefully, in a century, maybe, less years, slaughterhouses will have, disappeared. But then we'll have the memory of what happened, what had occurred, and the billions of creatures that, were killed. What do we make of that? How do we, how are we going to be remembered? And what do we make of all that loss?
It's hard. And I think, you know, one of the ways that I think we can do it is to work actively against forgetting, right? And to work against, you know, currently, like I've been saying, you know, work for more transparency. And if hopefully one day, you know, people are no longer killing animals for consumption, then, you know, working to not forget what was done, because the saying goes, you either, learn history or you're doomed to repeat it. So I think it's critical that we don't lose sight of it. And I know even with I have a 9-year-old son, who doesn't eat meat, but you know, I have talks with him about meat consumption and you know what it means. And you know, those are hard talks because he genuinely, you know, loves animals, and the thought that other people are eating animals is, you know, hard to wrap his brain around. But I think it's important so that, you know, so that he knows. And then, you know, he can explain it to other people, which might not make him the most popular kid on the playground. But you know, it's important that we confront it, and you know, not lose sight of it. And like I said, and not, you know, and also pay attention to the ways that we've harmed ourselves in doing it this way too. I think that's a very important lesson as well.
So, Emmy, did you have anything more to add to the conversation before we stop the recording?
I can't think of anything else. You know, that was a good questions that kind of ran the full the full gamut of everything. I can't think of anything else.
Well, that's a good sign. I'll take it
Yeah,
as a
I
good
think
sign.
so.
I'm getting better at interviewing my guests, so
Yeah, it's definitely you know, a skill that you know, that you have to cultivate. It's a challenge. I know even in my own research, when I'm interviewing participants, the first few interviews are kind of rough, and then I hit my stride and it, you know, it gets better.
I need your tips for future interviews.
I think practice makes, if not perfection, then close to it.
Well, I have hours of practice now.
Yeah. Well, and I've been enjoying your podcast. It's nice to have, you know, the focused vegan attention. And you know, and the guests that you have on, sometimes there are areas where, you know, I haven't really given much thought to, and you know, it's nice to kind of think outside my narrow little box.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. You know, I don't agree with all of my guests, you know, but still, it is interesting to hear their views.
Yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, it's helpful because then I think your listeners, you know, it might help because they might not identify with one perspective, but you know, someone else's perspective might be similar to their own, and that might be what clicks for them.
And maybe with time, you know, I'll think about past conversations with guests and change my mind, you know. Amazing. So, Amy, thank you so much for having taken the time to answer my questions, for having been a guest on the show, for your great knowledge and scholarship. Is it, you know, is it only money or can we say scholarship?
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thanks again for the invitation.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.